are constitutionalists, and as such, we are vitally concerned about the matter of federalism, because we fervently desire to restore that delicate balance of powers between the federal and state governments, as between the branches of the federal government, which was designed by the founding fathers under the Constitution to guarantee the scheme of ordered liberty and inalienable rights that we cherish as citizens of these United States of America. My colleagues on this panel, Mr. Frum and Mr. Landis, will undoubtedly analyze this topic, past and present, from a philosophical point of view.
Oh, no.
Before introducing them, however, I wish to examine the topic, discussing briefly where federalism today is from a purely political perspective. 4 years ago, when the Reagan Revolution was formally inaugurated, the conservative president was swept into office on a platform promising a massive turnover of power and responsibility to state and local government. Indeed, Ronald Reagan had initially laid the groundwork for his new federalism program in 1975, when at the Executive Club of Chicago, during his unsuccessful campaign for the presidential nomination, he proposed a $90 billion scheme to dismantle federal programs and transfer the authority for them to the states and localities, along with the tax revenue sources they would require to finance these programs. Then, candidate Reagan made some exaggerated claims about his plan. For instance, and I quote, "An immediate tax cut, some of which might have be balanced by tax rises in the states, would be only the beginning of the savings that would be achieved. With such savings, it would be possible to balance the federal budget, make an initial $5 billion payment on the national debt, and cut the federal personal income tax of every American by an average of 23%. I quote. However, as we recall, this proposal met with skepticism among economists and politicians and derision in the media, and so Reagan backed away as he headed for primary defeat at the hands of the incumbent President Ford. The federalism issue did not resurface until the successful 1980 campaign was over. In his inaugural address, the new president declared that it was his intention, quote, to curb the size and influence of the federal establishment and to demand recognition of the distinction between the powers granted to the federal government and those reserved to the states or to the people. The original $90 billion idea was scaled down to a $28 billion program to shift 75% of the federal grant and aid programs to the states, which President Reagan sent to the Congress and the Congress massacred in 1981. What the White House proposed was a consolidation of 88 categorical grants into 7 major block grants to the states for a savings of $23.9 billion over 5 years. What the Congress finally enacted was one education block grant that failed even to include the 2 largest federal education programs, 4 health block grants made up of 19 categorical health programs, the establishment of a community services block grant to replace the programs administered by the Community Services Administration, and a couple of special block grants to Puerto Rico. Unfortunately, the nation's governors and mayors, especially those of the poorer recipient states under the federal formula, were less than enthusiastic about the idea. A majority of the National Governors Conference, including most Republican members, demanded federalization of all welfare programs as their price for support. Some administration officials were not supportive of the federalism initiative either. Others refused to negotiate with the governors about federalizing welfare. The result was that the divided administration dragged its feet and chances for any compromise died. Finally, the administration's proposed budget cuts amidst the deepening recession virtually destroyed any hope the White House may still have had for enactment of the federalism goals. The upshot was that in early 1983, the president sent Congress another $21 billion package, which attempted to combine 34 different federal programs into 4 mega block grants. Again, this program went nowhere. The 1984 Republican Party platform, like the more conservative document 4 years earlier, contains a strong endorsement of the new federalism idea. The platform reads in part, and I quote, "For more responsible government, non-essential federal functions should be returned to the states and localities wherever prudent. They have the capability, knowledge, and sensitivity to local needs required to better administer and deliver public service. Their diverse problems require local understanding." The platform goes on to praise, quote, "the bold initiatives," unquote, "already undertaken by the Reagan administration," but adds that, quote, "the job of making government more accountable to the people has just begun." Well, as you know, the president avoided talking about the new federalism concept or the specifics of any new proposals, or for that matter, any concepts or specific proposals about anything during the 1984 campaign. The machinery which the administration had set up in the first term is still intact, however. There is still an advisory committee on federalism, and there is still a presidential assistant for intergovernmental affairs. Mr. Rich Williamson, the first intergovernmental affairs assistant, has moved on to better, if not necessarily bigger, things in Vienna, Austria. And his White House post is now held by one Lee Verstandig, a liberal former Brown University professor who was for 2 years an aide to that well-known Reaganite Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island. Mr. Standing then served without distinction, first as an Assistant Secretary of Transportation, and then as Acting Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency in the wake of Ann Burford's resignation. Whether Mr. Verstandig will be any more successful than Mr. Williamson in selling the Reagan federalism proposals to the governors, mayors, and members of Congress is doubtful. As you may recall, President Reagan made regulatory reform, and I say regulatory reform, not deregulation, a major element of his economic program when he first took office. However, during his first 4 years, the Reagan administration made no significant effort. It did not even submit to Congress any legislation to abolish, dismantle, or even scale back a federal department or agency. And not surprisingly, not a single department or agency has been eliminated. The 1980 GOP platform had promised that a Republican administration would abolish both the Department of Education and the Department of Energy. Both are humming along nicely today. The education budget, in fact, is the largest in history. And I expect that both departments will still be intact come 1988. Although the rate of federal spending growth has been slowed under Reagan, government spending and the number of federal employees, especially the White House staff, continues to increase. And it should also be pointed out that the 1984 Republican platform does not even call for dismemberment of the Education Department. Where does that leave us? Well, it seems unlikely the so-called Reagan Revolution will produce any revolutionary change in the Washington landscape, either in the size or dimensions of the federal government, or power-wise in its relationship with the states and local governments. Don't look for President Reagan to deregulate or dismantle government, or even make such proposals any more in the next 4 years than he has done during the past. And given the failure of the Reagan juggernaut to extend to Congress, with the uncertainties of the off-year congressional elections just 2 years away, the uncertainty of the makeup of the White House staff and its future personnel policies, and the certainty of the president's lame duck status, the outlook for the new federalism idea is very bleak and growing dimmer. To explain further the causes of the failure of the Reagan Federalism Initiative, and to discuss what conservatives can and must do during and after Reagan II, to redress this imbalance of federal power, which threatens to undermine this federalist system. I want to call on today our panel of two distinguished conservative experts who will offer some insights on federalism far more perceptive than the ones you've been patiently been listening to from me. I'd like to introduce them to you in order of their appearance, I guess, you gentlemen. Okay, fine. In reverse order in which they're seated at the table. First, Mr. David Frum, who is a native of Toronto, Canada, where he also attended schools. However, I'm most happy to say that he's also a graduate of Yale University, where he also received his master's in history on the subject of the military collapse of South Vietnam in 1975. At Yale, he distinguished himself as captain of the debating team, and he was a weekly columnist in the Yale Daily News. Nevertheless, I'm assured he's a conservative. Between 1982 and 1984, he's been published in various Canadian and American periodicals, including National Review and the Financial Post of Toronto and Saturday Night Magazine. He entered Harvard Law School in the fall of 1984, and that's where he is today. Mr. Frum, I'll ask you to start our discussion.
Thank you.